Welcome to the Corlin Economics Report, a weekly look at financial and political topics relating to asset-based investing. Guests on this program pay no fees to appear, and guests and hosts disclose any equity interest in companies profiled. Now, the Corlin Economics Report.
Hey everyone, welcome in to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Corey Fleck here along with Shad Marquitz. We're your hosts for this weekend's edition, also your hosts throughout the week on our website, kereport.com, and podcast, Corlin Economics Report. Throughout the week, boy oh boy, we just continue to put out company updates and market commentary because there's a lot to talk about. There are a lot of companies that are releasing news, and there continues to be this high volatility in a wide range of markets. No matter what you're looking at, whether it's safer assets or more risk on assets, it seems like day after day, you look at the markets and you just don't know which side the volatility is going to be on, whether your favor or going against you. We are going to discuss this as well as a number of other topics, focus more on commodities and precious metals, as we are kicking off the show with Adrian Day, president of Adrian Day Asset Management, also manages the Euro Pacific Gold Fund. Adrian, let's start off high level. As I mentioned, volatility across the board. It really has been the story of Q1 2022. Volatility and a lot of sectors under pressure, especially those performing sectors through the first half to three quarters of last year. They had a bit of trouble to start off this year. And then we had the war between Russia and Ukraine that popped up that just added to the underlying volatility. Adrian, what's your takeaway? Starting with U.S. equity markets and the volatility and slightly downward pressure that we have seen on the markets, at least early on this year.
Yeah, okay. Well, good morning, Corey and Chad. You know, my feeling on the broad market is, first of all, is the market is very overvalued. And it's not just the high-tech stocks, you know, that were the leaders. It's pretty much across the board. The market is overvalued. And I think increasingly investors accept that it's overvalued. At the same time, there is a sense, first of all, that the Federal Reserve, as it has done so many times in the past, will not let the market drop, you know, the famous Greenspan put that's been there for 30 years now. And the market investors have been conditioned to just expect that when the market goes down, the best thing to do is to buy. And there's also, even though you think the market's overvalued, there's, you know, our friends FOMO and Tina, there's no fear of missing out, and there isn't any alternative. That's the narrative. I don't agree with that. But most of the buying that I see in the broad stock market today, I'm talking broadly speaking, is mechanical and based on sentiment. But it sure isn't based on fundamentals. You know, obviously, gold and commodities, the reasons for volatility is a little bit different. You know, the war obviously saw things spike up tremendously. And then when we saw, particularly with gold, gold has reacted to the headlines on an almost daily basis. If it looks like Ukraine and Russia might be talking, there might be a ceasefire, you know, gold retreats. If that falls apart and there's heavy shelling in the city, gold moves up. But, you know, it's not unusual. I think we should point this out. It's not unusual for gold, geopolitical spikes in gold to be sharp and short-lived. Geopolitical influences on markets typically don't last a long time. And so when we saw gold rush up on the invasion to over 2050, it really isn't surprising that it started to give a lot of that back. If you look at where we are now, I mean, to me, the strength of gold is shown by the way that it has held support above 1900 and has bounced back quite sharply over the last 2 days. That's a sign of great strength, in my view.
Well, Adrian, yes, it's interesting to look at the dynamics from last year to this year in all those markets. When you look at the general markets, there were signs last year that there was sickness under the surface. When you looked at the breadth indicators, there was a lot of companies making 52-week lows in the NASDAQ and in the S&P earlier last year, but valuations didn't seem to matter, and it seemed like there was only one direction go up, and we've seen that narrative change where a lot of the growth stocks sold off hard over the last few months, even before this year started, starting at the end of last year. And there was a trend to move over into from growth and into value. And value is found in the commodities and the energy sector. It's found in gold, as you highlighted, and it's gotten more of a bid. And gold was getting a bid from the end of last year into the beginning of this year before Ukraine. And as you mentioned, the geopolitical event just kind of spiked the punch bowl a little bit. But are you encouraged in gold that we are seeing a close today in the mid-1940s to end the month of March, but also to end the first quarter? That's the highest quarterly close on record in gold ever today. So we're kind of making history with the, it doesn't seem like a lot after having a bigger move just a couple of weeks ago, but 1940s is the highest quarterly close ever. So is that encouraging to you, I guess, from a longer term standpoint in the precious metals?
No, you hit the nail on the head. It's very encouraging. And I would point out that, as you said, gold was already moving up before the war, before even the heightened tension between Ukraine and Russia. You know, you go back to, you know, the middle of January or the end of January when, you know, gold kind of bottomed. You look at a trend line, we're just right there on that trend line. And so what's happened is that geopolitical premium to a large extent has gone away, but gold has simply gone back to what I'll call its monetary trend line. And I know we're probably going to, well, I suspect we're going to talk about that a little bit later. But even if the war in Ukraine ended tomorrow, I think gold is, and gold would fall at that point, no question. But gold is still very, very powerful just based on, well, based on, forget war, based on inflation, based on the outlook for the global economy, and based on what the monetary authorities are likely to do given inflation in the global economy.
Adrian, can you outline that a little bit more in terms of how much you think gold could fall if this war does end tomorrow? Because quite frankly, even go back to the beginning of the war, which was tail end of February, gold actually isn't all that much higher. It spiked higher immediately after, but has given back the vast majority of those gains already.
Yeah. Well, I think we, as you say, we've given back the we've given back virtually all of those gains, the war gains. But as you know, markets always go to, you know, they swing on a pendulum and they always swing too far one way and too far the other way. So if we had a ceasefire announced, you know, in the next 5 minutes, gold would drop below that, what I've just referred to as the monetary trend line. There's no question. How far would it drop? I mean, I can't see it going much below 1870, frankly, even in what I'll call the best of circumstances or the worst of circumstances for gold. I can't see it going much below 1870. And I really don't think it would last very, very long there before the monetary factors reassert. So I don't think the risk in gold is very high at this point.
Well, Adrian, you brought up the monetary trend line. I think that's a great point. I think people have become so tunnel vision on the geopolitical side that they forgot that we have slowing growth estimates. We've got high inflation, as you noted. We've got the central bank policy where they've started their hiking cycle, not just in the U.S., but in Canada, in Europe. They're looking at it in Asia. So it's really a global trend of hawkish central banks to fight the rising inflation. Do you think that'll continue to underpin a move, not just in gold and silver, but possibly in the commodity sector, as we've already been seeing?
Yeah, and the first thing I say is I would not describe Federal Reserve policy as hawkish, more hawkish than it has been, but hardly hawkish. I mean, we've made the point before. Let's not forget, but if inflation stays where it is, and you have the most aggressive interest rate hikes that the Fed, any member of the Fed, is talking about, and right now we're talking about hiking at every meeting through the beginning of 2023, with 50 points for the next two meetings, followed by 25 points for the next meetings, you are still talking about negative real interest rates. You are still talking about interest rates that are more negative in real terms than they were at the dawn of the 1970s inflation. That's really worth reminding ourselves about. And the balance sheet. I mean, last week, when the numbers came out, the Fed is still adding to its balance sheet. They're talking about, we're going to start reducing it soon. Powell said, maybe at the next meeting, and they will reduce, start reducing the balance sheet. But as of today, they are still adding. Now, you know that old saying, people say, when you're in a hole, the first thing is stop digging. And the Federal Reserve hasn't learned that yet. So even I mentioned interest rates would still be negative when they at the end of, you know, at the end of another year. If you look at the balance sheet, again, even if you take the most aggressive predictions or forecasts that any Federal Reserve member has made about reducing the size of a balance sheet, it will a year from now, it will still be almost twice what it was in 2020. So this is not a hawkish policy by any means. Hawkish was Volcker coming in and raising rates to 20%. That was hawkish. This isn't hawkish. And the Fed is in a difficult position. I mean, everybody knows this, but I think we just have to focus on it. The Fed is in a difficult position of its own making. We should never forget that. People say to me, what mistakes do you think the Fed is going to make over the next few months? I say, forget the mistakes they're going to make over the next few months. The big mistakes have already been made by putting us in this position. It's simply impossible for the Federal Reserve to raise rates sufficiently to calm inflation without causing a recession. It cannot happen. So sooner or later, the Fed will, in my view, reverse course. Now, I've said before, I don't think that they will back away from higher interest rates at the first sign of trouble because they've got a shred, whatever shred of credibility they still retain is still on the line. So I think, I suspect that they will let the stock market fall and not be too worried about that. But you start getting unemployment start moving up, which is not a concern at the moment. But you start seeing unemployment moving up, and I think the Fed will pivot quite quickly. But they have to choose between letting inflation go or having a recession.
Well, and that really is what this year is all about, right? Or what we all thought it would be about, and that is the Fed, not just the Fed, but other central banks going through a general tightening process, or at least being a little less hawkish from where they were really since the pandemic hit. And we have seen the market start to factor some of this in when you look at interest rates. Interest rates, while still very historically low, have expanded quite drastically, threefold in some cases. We also have seen a flattening, even short-term inversion of the yield curve. But Adrian, how important do you think it is to watch the bond market and see these increasing yields ahead of a slow Fed tightening cycle?
Yeah, no, absolutely. The bond market traditionally is a better indicator of the economy than the stock market. And that's been true historically. And the bond market has finally started to take things into their own hands. I don't think we can yet call them bond vigilantes with rates exactly where they are. Because under the Taylor rule for the Fed, you know, John Taylor was a Fed member, Fed economist, and proposed that the Fed should use a firm rule for guiding interest rates. And under the Taylor rule, Fed funds rate would now be at 12%. So even if you cut that by half, we're still a long, long way from where interest rates should be. But clearly, you know, interest rates, as you know, they move in very long cycles. So we've had 40 years of declining interest rates. in the around the world, and that is normal for interest rates. Interest rates will last a whole generation, typically. So we've definitely seen the bottom in interest rates, and you know, people just don't want to lend money anymore for 0.5%.
Well, Adrian, I think you're spot on there. I think that when we saw those really low rates down around 40 bips in August of 2020, that was probably the top of the bond bubble after a four-decade run. And since then, the bond bubble has kind of burst. And as you mentioned, the bond markets are finally starting to take things in their own hands, maybe not vigilantes yet, but they are starting to front run what the central bank policy is going to be of hiking rates. But as you mentioned, if we were going to implement the Taylor rule, we'd have to have dramatically higher interest rates than what we have now. And the Fed's fund rate would have to be higher than inflation, which at the debt load they're carrying now, which is trillions of dollars, would make the debt servicing on, you know, impossible mathematically. So is there a point where you think that they will reverse course, as you mentioned? And could that be the point that really spikes the precious metals when they finally admit exactly they can't go any higher?
Well, absolutely, 100%. But I think the gold market is already anticipating that. You know, I think we talked about it last time, but the last three times that the Fed has started to tighten, either raising interest rates 2005, 2013, and then started tapering 2015, the last time they started to tighten, gold bottomed the day they actually started. And that's because the gold market anticipates that they won't do enough for as long as they should. It's too little, too late, and it won't last long enough. And in a way, that's what we saw this year. The Fed's been talking about raising rates now since last summer. And that hurt gold because, again, gold typically falls ahead of the start of the tightening program. But, you know, when you saw gold, when you saw the Fed say, okay, next meeting, we're going to do it, we really mean it, then gold started moving up. And when they reverse course, of course, then that will really send gold flying.
Adrian, let's drive down into some of the gold stocks then, because we do have a lot of very active investors that listen and they're trying to manage their portfolio. A lot are, I think, also stuck in some juniors, which quite frankly just haven't been moving, but the majors, they continue to move higher. Newmont just this week was hitting all-time highs, I believe, and it just goes to show that money has come more into the majors and the larger companies, really hasn't filtered down into the mid-tiers or the juniors, no matter what stage of junior you seem to be. Do you think there's still upside in the majors, or do you think it's finally time for money to filter into the mid-tiers and juniors, or do you think it got a little overheated and we might have a little correction ahead of us?
Well, so first of all, it's, as you know, it's perfectly normal in the beginning of a gold market for gold bullion to move up and the senior gold stocks, the major gold stocks, to move up before the mid-tiers and the juniors. That's perfectly normal. In the kind of environment where we are now, remember gold, as Frank Holmes keeps talking about, there's the fear trade, the love trade. Gold reacts. If gold is reacting to fear, whether it's geopolitical fear or fear of the economy, then in that kind of environment, all the more so does bullion move first and the seniors move next. And juniors, which are not really a very good asset to hold if you're afraid of the world falling apart, they don't move typically. They don't move very much at all. Their time will come, don't get me wrong, but it is not, what we're seeing now is not unexpected or what you shouldn't be expecting in this kind of environment. Now, when we talk about the seniors, yes, they've gone up a lot, but, you know, I just looked at the XAU, which is, you know, the index of U.S. leading U.S. gold and silver stocks. You know, the yield of 1.7% is pretty much the highest, other than 2012-13, the highest in the last 20 years. A high yield means low valuation. You look at the price earnings multiple, we're close to the lowest in 20 years. So on valuation basis, on a valuation basis, if the companies continue to deliver, that's a different topic, then the valuations are still very, very close to their lows. And I think there's a lot further to go in the gold stocks, both in terms of price and in terms of valuation. So I don't think it's too late to be in the seniors by any means. But I do think one can start to, you know, pick away at the better quality. Well, at the juniors that either have a catalyst, because when there's a catalyst, they are responding, right? Or at the better quality ones that have, you know, good balance sheets, and we don't have to worry about them constantly raising money and diluting. So I definitely think we can, you know, we can start putting more money to work with the juniors, no question.
Well, Adrian, when you look at the dynamics of inflation and how that's affected the producers, it has caused their cost inputs to go up. So the narrative last year was also that, hey, their margins are being compressed, even though the pricing was still pretty good in gold and silver. But now we're seeing the pricing move higher again, which should help their margins. Are you attracted by that aspect of the producers? Do you like that the royalty companies don't really have to deal with that? Or do you like going down the food chain a little bit more into some of the development projects that and the exploration projects that will feed the industry? What area or sectors really have your attention right now?
Well, I was going to say yes to your question. Yes to all of them. You know, I'm a big proponent of the royalty companies for the reasons you mentioned. A, they don't have to worry about cost inflation, and B, the other important point, of course, is that they're typically far more diversified than the major. You can look at a major mining company that might have 8 or 9 projects. You look at Franco-Nevada, it's got revenue from 40 projects. So much more diversified, and simply because of that diversification, lower risk. As I mentioned, evaluations on the seniors are still very, very compelling. So, you know, I like some of the biggest of the big miners. And then, you know, the developers and the smaller producers, we've got to see more takeovers. I mean, we're seeing it. It's increasing, as you know, especially after COVID travel restrictions have ended and people can do more due diligence. We're beginning to see more takeovers, but that trend is only going to continue. And then again, you look at some of the exploration companies that are simply, there's no blue sky premium in the sector as a whole. So, you know, I think you can get into some of these things if you're patient, very cheaply. So, I mean, in answer to your question, yes, I'm looking at all of them. I'm still putting more money into the larger and smaller royalties and into the senior producers. I'm still putting more money into those than I have traditionally. I still think that's the best place to be in the near term for both a risk and a reward. Because, you know, we can talk about the inflows into gold. Let's face it, most institutional investors today are still extremely underweight gold. Extremely underweight. And when they move into gold in any way, they're going to buy bullion, they're going to buy the index, and they're going to buy, you know, Barrick and Newmont and Franco. They're not going to buy Ajax Exploration. So those are the sectors, those are the subsectors that will move first, will continue to move, I should say, no question in my mind.
All right, well, Adrian, before we get you out of here then, any stocks that you care to share with us or further trading strategies, please?
The other thing I'm looking at is when there's a good quality company whose stock gets hit for some temporary reason or an exaggerated hit. And two examples I'll give just recently, Osisko Mining, you know, Osisko Gold Royalties, rather, OR New York, they came out with a very large equity raise. And the stock fell sharply. That often happens. It's not unusual for a stock to fall when there's a bought deal at a discount to the market and the stock fell below the price of the offering. That's not unusual. But it's an opportunity for people who've been watching the stock to jump back in. little bit, it's moved back up today, so I'm not buying it today, but that's a good example. Another good example would be Fortuna Silver. You know, they had a pretty darn good quarter and a pretty darn good year, and yet they missed their headline earnings because of exceptional factors, both because of losses on some hedges, but they had, the hedges were on tin and zinc, and they also hedged their diesel, the diesel hedges. So, you know, and that was a positive because, of course, they buy diesel. So selling it, buying it at a lower price was a positive. But if you look at the base metals that they hedged, you know, they lost some of the upside. I'm not upset about them hedging their byproducts, frankly. They don't hedge gold and silver. But that meant that they, and then there were some tax issues and some foreign exchange issues. So the headline earnings was a miss, small miss, and everybody dumps the stock. You know, it's just automatic for some of these firms. You know, someone misses their earnings by a penny, sell the stock. And let's look at why they missed later. So very good opportunity to buy a company like Fortuna. And we're still buying that today, by the way. But so I'm looking at things like that. And those happen, you know, every week of the year. There's some company but whose stock drops for some temporary reason.
All right, Adrian, we'll wrap it up here, but I really like your comment that there is no blue sky premium in the sector, because you're right, there is no blue sky premium, and quite frankly, even assets in the ground are still getting valued quite low. It just seems like there are a lot of million-plus ounce resources out there that just aren't getting the value, so we'll see when that money does start to trickle lower. Either way, Adrian, great having you on the show. Always a pleasure chatting with you. We'll have you back on probably next month. But again, thank you for kicking off this weekend show. I hope you have a great rest of your weekend.
Well, thank you very much, and thank you to the listeners.
Al Corlin's firm, A.B. Corlin & Associates Incorporated, provides consulting services to public companies on matters of regulatory compliance. To find out more, follow the link from www.kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back after this brief timeout. Your weekly fix on finance and investing. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. Those first two segments with Adrian Day, very interesting. We did focus a lot on precious metals. So the tail end of this show, I do want to focus a bit more big picture because, look, there was a lot going on in this first quarter. And as we started off with Joel talking about volatility, I think that was one of the takeaways from the first quarter. Also rising interest rates and just this real uncertainty that we had that really got, I guess, distracted in a sense in terms of the war too, or amped up in that way because of some of the war premiums we saw. But quite frankly, it looks like a lot of those war premiums have come back a little bit by the end of the quarter. We are now chatting with Joel Alkonen, co-host of the Benzinga Pre-Market Prep Show, also editor of the Pre-Market Prep website. We usually chat with Joel on Tuesdays, but we pushed it back this week. And Joel, I'm glad we did, just so we could have you on the weekend show and really recap this first quarter. Let's start with the U.S. equity markets, because as much bearishness as we are hearing, markets were down. They're nowhere near their lows of the quarter, but we did see some selling at the tail end, the very last day of the quarter on Thursday. We're even starting off this next quarter, starting off April, down as well. Joel, what's your takeaway from about 6% decline in the S&P and, again, all this bearishness that we keep hearing?
Good afternoon. Thanks for having me on this Adjusted Friday. I think you just had a gift rally that I think one that investors, I mean, it's still not too late to perhaps look at your portfolio. Our gains on Tuesday when we were 170 points from the all-time high was predicated on a de-escalation in the war. That is not happening. In fact, the opposite is happening. The market just has a funny way of emphasizing good headlines and de-emphasizing bad headlines. So that was, you know, we're going to have our third down day in a row right now, if we close where we are, where we're trading right now, we're going to be down for the week. I think it was a turn. I think there's still a lot of uncertainty in the market regarding interest rates, regarding inflation, fighting inflation, the war, and it's just hard for me to be optimistic about Q2. I mean, you got earnings coming up, right? We'll see how earnings are, of course, but there were big selling balances on the close yesterday, and there was a lot of gap downs, and those money managers weren't, there were day trades they were getting out of. They were getting out of stuff, you know, based on the quarter and the quarterly performance. So I'm not optimistic here. In fact, I'm as bearish as I've been in a long time.
Yeah, Joel, it does sound like a more bearish outlook, but that means that this relief rally or gift rally, as you called it, would probably be a good idea for people to lighten up on positions that they maybe have nice profits in just to lock them in, it sounds like. Or are you looking at even potentially shorting the markets here?
Yeah, I mean, I'm not, I'm always looking to short the market, but no, I mean, and once again, you know, we go back, you know, quite a few years in doing this. It all depends where you are on your investment horizon, you know, retired, you know, where you're at, what you're doing with your assets. For young people like you guys, it's obviously a little bit different. But, you know, not, you know, so much that, you know, maybe getting out of stuff, but, you know, maybe not, you know, maybe, but pick a stop, pick an area, you know, if you'd own something that, you know, one of these high flyers that's come all the way down and it's gotten some of it back and you're hoping to get break even, maybe say, hey, you know, maybe put a stop in or something mental. So at least you're not, if we go back down to those quarterly lows, you're not thinking, oh my, you know, why didn't I do that? So I'm not really putting any new money to work in the market. I'm not taking, you know, a ton off. I'm still not at that point of, you know, dumping the long-term portfolio. Anyways, the wife doesn't let me do that or else we'd be flat all the time. But yeah, I mean, there's just been like the rally, it just had an apple. I mean, come on, 150 to 180, 20% on like a big cap stock like that. I mean, if you think this is going from 170 to 200 in a heartbeat, man, you got another thing coming. These are just like 11 up days in a row. These are just historical moves. And, you know, you got to take these advantages, you know, when you can, because it's very hard to sell into a down market. And that's what, you know, we can very well be, you know, looking at here in the next quarter.
Yeah, volatility, though, too, right? When we're seeing Apple move 20%, boy, oh, boy, there's a lot of money just sloshing around, which I guess does provide some opportunity for day traders. But overall, the trend has been lower. Joel, how much of this is predicated on the environment that we have now of higher interest rates, tightening central banks around the world? Is that the main issue, or is it simply the fact that the reopening trade is over and people are eventually starting to run out of money?
Yeah, I mean, for sure. I mean, you know, look at that, you know, average, I mean, their housing price. I mean, have you looked at housing stocks? I mean, are people going out and buying new house, you know, price of houses after the median price has gone up half or double, you know, in the last year or so? You know, are people going to be going to Disney World? Are people going to have the kind of discretionary income? Are they going to be getting checks from the government? I mean, there's a lot of things. Rents are going up. It's going to, you know, there's eventually going to be a point where, yeah, the inflation, you know, is good for selling things, but eventually you're going to get, you know, demand destruction. Prices are just going to be too high and people are not going to be able to afford things. So that's, you know, once again, I'm kind of going off the rails here on the bearish side, but, you know, we don't know what the Fed's going to do, right? I mean, we know that they're on a path to curb, you know, inflation, and, you know, how long is it going to take? And then you get your other worry war, so, well, they're going to tighten too much, and then we're going to go into a recession. I can't predict that far out. All I know is that we're in an inflationary environment, and you know, you have to, you know, position your portfolio accordingly.
Well, Joel, you brought up real estate there, and in a rising interest rate environment, generally home prices eventually start to sell off and the home prices tank a little bit, because as the interest rates go up and the cost of borrowing money goes up, the inflated price levels that things have gotten to usually subside. So I'm wondering, will that have a ripple effect like it did in 2008 and 2009, where we saw the housing market get hit to some degree, and then that affected construction workers, which then affected supply and then affected raw commodities. So could there be that aspect to this interest rate rise where people are getting squeezed with inflation? They're getting squeezed, you know, at the gas pump, at the grocery store. Consumer discretionary spending is down. So I would imagine that new home buyers may hesitate to jump into the market at this point. Do you think it could hit the real estate market?
I mean, you've already seen it in these housing stocks. Lennar had a, you know, had a great quarter. Like they made KB Homes or Lamar, like I think had their best quarter ever. They popped to 92, and now they're hovering on the lows of the move. Also, when you look at a comparison to what the market did over the last 2 weeks, it's just an absolutely horrible relative performance. So, you know, prices go up really fast, but then they tend to trickle down. And I think what I think we have to differentiate between now and 2008, because I hope we've learned something from the financial crisis and there's not as much, you know, subprime lending. I wouldn't want to be on a floating rate right now. But you know, the housing market too ties, you know, that supports you like your Home Depots and your Lowe's. I mean, and it's tied to a lot of, you know, different sectors of the economy. And then also rising prices. I mean, it takes more gas money to go to McDonald's to pay something for higher prices. So there's a lot of different angles that unfortunately are not pointing in the right direction.
So Joel, are you saying that we're going to have a big collapse here? Is this going to be another recessionary pullback, or is this going to be in your eyes?
I don't know.
Okay. Is there anything that's going to be safe out there anywhere that people can put their money that could benefit from this weakness, potential crash?
I mean, they say, you know, gold, that, you know, that had its run, that's been all over the place. You know, commodities, I mean, you know, that, you know, theoretically are supposed to be. I'll tell you right now, and I'm not going to fight it, and I'm not going to join it, but like, have you looked at utilities? I mean, this makes absolutely no sense. Have you seen the utilities? I mean, I hate to say, you know, I mean, they bucked the trend so far, and I guess that's part of the energy play, but I'm looking at what's held up, and I'm looking at the XLU at an all-time high. Duke Energy, I mean, higher prices means they can charge higher. So I don't know. Utilities have proved chew and chew over the course of time. You maybe did not make as much money in these rip-roaring rallies. You certainly don't lose as much money on the downside. So, I mean, I don't want to be boring and have your people turn off the radio, but I mean, or whatever they're listening on, but like the utility chart. I mean, I'm not going to try and call top in that, but if you want to put your money in, there's some pretty good yields out there. So growth tech, you know, I mean, they've had some bounces here, but we all know in a rising interest rate environment, growth tech is not the place to be. Bitcoin, it's hard. I don't think it's going to ever be the Bitcoin of old. I think it's going to be more of a trading range. I mean, it's hard to touch China. So I'm hard pressed to find a safe haven for you, Corey.
Well, Joel, a lot of people have turned to the utilities because it is more of a defensive sector, just like a lot of people have started turning to consumer staples. And we mentioned last week that a lot of people were turning to Berkshire Hathaway just as, again, another safe play. You mentioned yields. You know, that might be an area to explore, is that there are a lot of defensive stocks and energy stocks that have really good yields. And so you could get a dividend while you're kind of riding out the storm. What do you think of that idea of just taking a more defensive posture, but getting some yield while you wait?
I think that's what, you know, you've seen a clear rotation into that. It's just a, you know, a question, are you late to the game, or is this going to be, you know, a persistent trend? I mean, one thing that, growth kind of eat that, you know, growth value, you know, growth did okay, which is, you know, not, you know, it's kind of contrary. So, yeah, I safe havens, getting some yield, a little bit protection. Yeah. Would rebalance your portfolio a little bit into more conservative things. I could definitely see that as a possibility.
All right, Joel, you know what? We're going to wrap it up here. I think we've given enough bearishness to
everybody. I'm sorry, guys.
Hey, man, I don't blame you. Look, there is a lot of bearishness out there. You're not the only one bearish, and we don't always need to be bullish on markets. Quite frankly, it's a very different world, and we're already seeing that just from last year. The markets had much easier time last year, but the reopen trade is now over. We have central banks tightening. Quite frankly, there's a lack of new liquidity coming into these markets, and now we're seeing some high volatility. So it very much was a different quarter.
Still, we're right near all-time highs. I mean,
that is true.
Well, what do you people want? That's how it concluded, okay?
Boom, there you go. Joel, thank you. Have a great rest of your weekend. We'll chat again next week, buddy.
To find out more about today's guests, visit us on the web at www.kereport.com. You're listening to the Corlin Economics Report. We'll be back in a moment. Providing unique reporting on markets and companies since 1990. This is the Corlin Economics Report.
All right, welcome back, everybody. Here to wrap up the weekend edition of the KE Report. We are going to be, again, talking a bit more generally, and who knows, maybe just as negatively as Joel was on the last segment. However, I think we might get some other trading strategies here as we are chatting with Dana Lyons, fund manager based out of Chicago, also editor at the Lion Share website, which I will link to within the weekend show posting. Now, Dana, as I said last segment, we had Joel Conan on, and he was quite bearish about these markets. And you know what? There are a lot of bears out there for these markets, and the markets were down for this first quarter, which was very different than pretty much any of the quarters last year. However, we are still only about 6% away from all-time highs, and we have seen just how volatile some big and small stocks have been. Dana, what's your takeaway? Are you just as bearish as we have been hearing in some prior segments about these markets?
Thanks, Corey. Actually, our work is kind of mixed right now. You know, we were, as you know, substantially bearish for most of the first quarter. Got evidence. The $30,000 question right now is whether, you know, that the bottom that we put in place was just merely a temporary low and led to, you know, a dead cat bear market bounce, and we're going back down to visit or make new lows, or whether it was like a longer term, more substantial intermediate term bottom. And we've got evidence really to support both ways. So our work is still up in the air right now. We have seen significant improvement in a lot of our risk model, including areas pertaining to breadth. But we're not there yet. We don't have the all clear signal. And same thing on the charts. You know, there are some areas that have substantially rallied back, overcome most areas of resistance, and are actually either at new highs or setting up probable rallies to new highs. On the other hand, you have plenty of areas of market, the equity market, that has been more or less a dead cat bounce back up into initial areas of resistance, and it's failing right now. So from that standpoint, our strategy right now, until we get more clarity on the big picture, is to focus on the trees instead of the forest. All right, pick those areas of the market that are more clearly longs, more clearly areas that we want to be long, and on the flip side, highlight or identify and more aggressively trade on the short side those areas that are more vulnerable, more technically not constructive on the charts, and look vulnerable to testing the lows again. So that's our strategy right now until, you know, like I said, the bigger picture kind of clears up a little bit more.
Well, Dana, I got to tip my hat to you, because at the end of last year, you were looking at the breadth warnings and figured that the first quarter would be more bearish, and you were spot on with that. But then you also, the last couple times we talked, noted that you'd seen enough indicators on your quantitative methods and some of the technical analysis that you were looking at that a bottom was put in, and you knew there was going to be a bounce. So now the question is it going to be a dead cat bounce in some sectors, as you mentioned, or will there be some follow through? So I like the idea of you just focusing on the individual trees instead of worrying about the entire market direction and looking for which sectors could have good momentum to the upside, and which sectors are in resistance and you're looking to short. Would you like to unpack some of that? Which sectors are you thinking maybe have sustained momentum to the upside, and which sectors are you thinking maybe are just bouncing up to resistance to fall back down again and you're looking to short?
Sure. Well, let's start with the latter group. So the areas we want to be selling and potentially aggressively shorting are two main areas. The tech and growth area, we are definitely selling rallies. They've shown no evidence that, you know, either technically that they've regained enough ground to make a run, a more sustainable run. Fundamentally, those companies in that area, the market still has tremendous challenges and headwinds for it. So we want to be selling, especially there in the high growth and tech area. And the other one is Europe. Pretty clearly, Europe got washed out in that sell-off to those February lows. We were actually buying them because we got better washout, better capitulatory signals in Europe at those lows in February than we did in the U.S. So we bought a bunch of European markets there. We're basically hitting, or have hit in the last few days, our best case scenario for that bear market bounce in Europe. And we've sold all of our longs and have fairly aggressively started shorting over the last week to a couple of days in Europe. So those are a couple of areas on the short side we would focus on. On the long side, I mean, there's, you know, if you look closely enough, there are areas that are already bounced back and are hitting new highs again. So you look at the utilities, which is hitting new highs, held up very well during that bounce in interest rates. And I think we talked about last time the fact that it did hold up well, now it's hitting new highs, maybe suggests that, which was our thesis, that maybe interest rates are topping now for the, at least in the near term. We think they eventually go up again, but that would certainly be a continued headwind or tailwind, excuse me, for utilities. You've got other areas like the agriculture names. You look at the ETF MOO hitting new highs, all-time highs. So that's another area of the market we've been focused on. Value, certainly, as opposed to growth, has maintained its leadership, especially in the large cap value area of the market, which is hitting new highs. Another ticker symbol would be RPV. It's the large cap pure value ETF that just in the last few days bounced back to all-time highs. So, and then some international markets. You look at Mexico. Why is Mexico breaking out to all-time highs? I have all-time highs. No idea, but it is. And those are the types of names that we want to be in. There are others, but those are a couple examples of areas of the market. But it just goes to show you, you know, it's not one homogenous market right now. There are areas that are clearly better than others. So we want to kind of dig down deeper and focus on those trees, like I said, rather than the forest.
Dana, is this simply an environment here where we have higher interest rates and less available cash? So investors do need to be a bit more defensive. And quite frankly, that's why we're not seeing growth do very well. And a lot of people rotating into value, which started last year, end of last year.
Well, you know me, we're never looking for the whys and the reasons why moves happen. But I think it's probably pretty clearly that's a lot. It has a lot to do with it. Pretty clearly, the Fed has not tipped their hand that they're going to step off the pedal yet. So that's certainly one of those headwinds I was talking about. So that, if you're looking for a reason, I think that's, again, well, we don't care what the reason is. I think that's certainly very reasonable rationale for some of the moves that we've been having and likely to continue, I would think.
Well, Dane, I know we just got done talking about the trees and not the forest, because you've seen some that look like they continue their uptrend and you've seen some that look good to short. But if we focused on the forest for just a second, what will you be looking for to tell you that the uptrend could be sustained? And then on the downside, would it be a matter of it coming back and testing the previous low it put in, or would you be looking for it to make a lower low? Tell us what it would look like when you're convinced it's broken out, or when you think the markets may be showing us that we're in a longer bear market.
Well, simply on the upside, we need to see our risk model fully go to a positive posture. And that it hasn't done that yet. It's an intermediate term model, which means, you know, the typical signal is like 2 to 6 months And we're still waiting for a little bit more evidence from our signal, from our model to suggest the all clear. I mean, it doesn't mean it's going to be right, but it will be enough evidence for us at that point to get more aggressive on the long side and make a bigger bet that, you know, the bottom is in. I'm not waiting to see another test of the downside. I think we had enough tests of those lows. In fact, I was concerned in the beginning of March, middle of March, when we tested those lows for the third time, because rarely do you see, you know, a triple bottom or a triple top. It doesn't happen. You hear about it, but it doesn't happen too often. So I don't need to see another test of the lows to make for a more substantial bottom. In fact, if we go back down to the lows again, I would say there is a significant risk that eventually those are broken. We put in a new down leg. So that's just, you know, my sense. But again, objectively and quantitatively, we'll be watching our model and looking for more evidence that, overall, the broad market is indeed heading higher. And that's where we want to get a little bit more aggressive.
Dana, how are you viewing the commodity complex? Because commodities did do well, or at least the CRB did very well this quarter. It was driven a lot by energy prices moving higher, but we also did have things like copper hit all-time highs before reversing. So we have had a lot of pops in individual commodities for a number of different reasons. A lot of those highs have been faded by the end of the quarter, though. So how are you balancing out moves in commodities, and do you like any individual commodities?
Sure. Commodities are a lot like a lot of financial assets right now, kind of in a consolidation mode. You know, they had big moves. Stocks, for example, had big moves down and kind of consolidating. Commodities obviously had big rallies, and they're mostly in a consolidation mode right now, which means for us, the uptrend is still in place. So we want to continue to buy dips in commodities, whether it's oil, which is at a decent spot right now. Precious metals have been in basically the same spot for the last month or so, but we're still bullish on precious metals. And the grains will continue to buy dips in the grain market. So overall, still bullish on commodities until, you know, the uptrend is decisively broken and there's evidence to suggest that that up move is over. Until that happens, our thesis is that we're just in a continuation pattern and that should resolve to the upside.
What about the individual companies that are extracting the oil and gas or the base metals, or the agriculture or the precious metals? Do you have any thoughts on the actual companies that track those commodities?
Sure, not individual companies. We don't do individual companies, all ETFs, but from an equity standpoint and the commodities and precious metals, we are quite bullish on most of those commodity companies, whether it's, like I mentioned, the agriculture companies hitting new highs, or also bullish on energy. That feeds a lot into the value ETFs that are doing so well. And by the same token, the gold miners, silver miners, we continue to be bullish on those. We think they're constructively positioned. We think the next big move is an up move, and the next big up leg in their longer term bull market. So for the most part, across the board in commodity land and the equities tied to them, we're still pretty bullish.
So Dan, I've asked you this question before, but now that we have the first quarter behind us, and again, we have a lot of noise in these markets and a lot of different drivers, have you seen a time like this in these markets in history that you can go back to and read, or at least look at a playbook of how it played out in the past and use that as maybe a little bit of a guide to navigating this environment?
You know, markets from a micro standpoint, they're always changing, whether it's because of rules that are in place or whatnot. But from an overall standpoint, they're always driven by supply and demand and by sentiment and human nature. So from that standpoint, we've seen this play act out before many, many times. So it's always a little bit different in terms of the set of circumstances that are going on. But from, like, I always harp on reading the quantitative metrics and the and maintaining an objective frame of mind. And from that standpoint, you don't need a narrative. You don't need a rationale. You look at the numbers and which way the numbers, which direction the numbers are pointing you, and that's what we'll stick with. So I would say, again, from a historical precedent standpoint, it's certainly not the ideal, or I should say identical set of circumstances that we've ever seen. But on the flip side, markets will always be the same. They'll always, you know, people always get greedy and then they'll get fearful, and you got to take advantage of those. And in the middle, you ride the trend. So basically that's our philosophy, and we'll stick with it.
Fair enough, Dana. You have been quite spot on with these markets all throughout last year when things were going pretty smoothly, and then tail end of last year and early on this year, just finding the sectors that are doing well and not taking any biases into any individual sector. Pleasure having you on the show, Dana. I hope everybody enjoyed this weekend show. It was fun putting it together, even though, boy, oh boy, we were still getting a lot of negative comments. And I do caution people to dive too much into the whole negative aspect of these markets because, well, it does drive traffic being that negative, but it doesn't always have to be a crashing market, even though we are seeing weakness around these markets and broadly around the world, actually. Dana, thank you again for your time, everybody. Thank you for tuning in. Please keep in touch with us through email, flex@kereport.com and chad@kereport.com. We'll be back with all of you next week. So everyone, have a great rest of your weekend.